I think it's very tacky. I think it's very tacky when rabbis quote song lyrics as if they were poetry. When rabbis use a hockey team as a metaphor, or when rabbis refer to television. But man, we're living in a great era of television. There are some great, I don't know if you've seen Breaking Bad or Friday Night Lights or The Wire, but we are living in a golden age of non-network television. Westworld started last night. I didn't get to watch it, but I plan to after the holiday. And there's one show I've been watching a little recently. I don't think it's the most incredible show I've ever watched, but it teaches me something very powerful. There's a show on FX called Atlanta. It's put together by one of my favorite singers, Donald Glover, who's also an actor and a comedian and a fantastically good-looking gentleman. And it stars him and two people, who, one of whom is his cousin, not in real life, in the show, and the cousin's friend. And Donald Glover plays a college dropout. The cousin is a rapper and small-time drug dealer. And the friend is a marijuana addict, let's just say, for lack of a better word. At least, that's the way you would stereotype them if you saw them on the street. They would fit the casual stereotypes you might have, one might have, of African-American males. But what's wonderful about the show, what's really incredible by the fourth and fifth episodes, is that those characters are given a breadth and depth that goes beyond the easy and facile and superficial characterizations we might have had of them. The Princeton dropout, the college dropout, is a Princeton dropout. He's a dreamer and a businessman and a poet. The rapper and drug dealer wants more than anything else to be seen as a kind and gentle soul, but is pigeonholed into the role of criminal and hoodlum. And in, I think, the most touching episode, and people are saying that this actor is really the breakout of the show, the drug addict, when not high, as is true for so many drug addicts, is a genius. He's a genius. He showed in the fourth episode to be something of a commercial and otherwise genius. What's made this era of peak TV, as it's often called in the reviews, so phenomenal is that people, women, African Americans, Latinos, Palestinians, and others, have become lead actors. This process probably started sometime in the 90s when people like Jennifer Lopez and Jessica Alba and Dwayne Johnson came to prominence, that people whose faces we weren't used to seeing on the big screen in a starring role because they were female or darker skinned or not blonde or of a different body type than we were used to, became prominent characters, became stars in their own right, got to play roles like Omar in The Wire that transcended easy opinions, that were complex, that were anti-heroes, that challenged our assumptions of the way the world works and the way the underclass operates, and taught us that there is poetry in the life of those we don't look at very often. There's an article written by the essayist Janet Malcolm in The New Yorker. I don't recommend reading the article. I tried to read it recently. It's kind of a dull article about Gertrude Stein, but it contains a gem. She points out that the minor characters of biography, like their counterparts in fiction, are less tenderly treated than major characters. The writer uses them to advance his narrative and carelessly drops them when they perform their function. There are so many minor characters in Dickens or Madame Bovary or recent fiction. You take a paragraph, you give them one or two traits and move on. But here's where it gets complicated, says Ms. Malcolm. Unlike the flat characters of fiction, as E.M. Forster would have called them, who have no existence outside the novel they were invented to ornament, the flat characters of biography and likewise documentary, any kind of nonfiction, are actual three-dimensional people. I come back to that quote a lot. It's so easy to stereotype and pigeonhole people you run into in your life your hairdresser, the person who does your lawn. It's very easy to forget that minor characters in a documentary like Harlan County, USA, had their own lives, were full people. That the people you pass by and ignore, whether it's in a television show, a movie, in a political argument, in a court of law, they live a full life when you're not around. They have mothers and daughters and children and dogs and cats, dreams and aspirations. They read books. They watch television. They are different to you, but the same. The cornerstone of oppression, I think Ms. Malcolm is reminding us, is believing that minor characters in our lives, unlike minor characters in a novel, deserve only a few lines, deserve 20 or 30 words, a paragraph or two at most, a brief description. Return to the example of Atlanta. If you watch it someday, you think, you know, there's a character I would have given very short shrift to had I crossed him by on the street, if I'd actually been in Atlanta and seen Earn Marks, the young Princeton dropout. That's the trial of our age. We're living in a delicate time, a strange time, unprecedented in America and elsewhere, where women, minorities, the poor, well, for one thing, we're seeing them more in music and in art, which is good. And for another thing, we're seeing them more in the boardroom and in the political sphere and in the voting booth. And that scares the heck out of us, let's be honest. For most of us in this room, for many of us, it was nice to know that you were always going to get the lead in the play of This American Life. And now, that's not so assured. I'll speak more about the political system over Yom Kippur, but I think that's some of the fears that are being played on now. Maybe our role in the economy will be played by an Indian or someone in China. Maybe our seat in the boardroom, that role will be played by a woman or a Latino. We're not used to that. It's hard to swallow. And the cornerstone of oppression, as I mentioned, is putting people in their place, giving them a small role, and consigning them to be a secondary character. There are three stories I want to share with you, three examples of this, early in our Torah, in Genesis and Exodus. The first is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, Sodom and Amorah, which we often think, you know, especially in a Christian milieu, we read that story and think, the Sodomites were punished because they were engaging in homosexual sex, of which there is an inference one could make, that there was homosexuality in Sodom. But that's not what our rabbis were concerned about. Our rabbis were concerned about Sodom and vouchsafed that it was punished because it was a wicked place, because it was an oppressive place, because it didn't give a damn about the poor and the vulnerable, the strangers, the immigrants. We're told these beautiful, strange stories that'll need a little bit of explanation in the Talmud. That if a person had a row of bricks, let's say you were building your row of bricks, well, you'd get down to here, and some local from Sodom would come and grab a brick. Then another guy would grab another brick, and you'd be planning your row, and in the meantime, all the bricks would be gone. But because each person had only grabbed one brick, there'd be no crime to speak of. And if you spread out garlic or onions to dry, everyone would take just one. Who's going to prosecute the loss of one onion, the loss of one bulb of garlic, our sages would suggest? That was the wisdom, so to speak, of Sodom. And if a poor man would happen through Sodom, every resident would give him a coin, but it would be marked. It would be a marked bill. And no one would sell him bread. Those coins would be useless. Everyone would pretend to be charitable, pretend to help. But the charity was fruitless. And when the person would starve to death because no one would feed him, they would take their marked bills back, play the same charade with the next visitor. They could not envisage the experience of the minor characters in the town, the sojourners, the poor, The Sodomites didn't have any sense that people outside their town were worth a darn. They didn't have sympathy or empathy for the needs of people in passing roles in their drama. Imagine that you were a visitor. Imagine that you were trying to construct something in this town. And everything you did was chipped away. Every piece of your security was pulled out from under you bit by bit, law by law, ordinance by ordinance. Okay, that's Sodom and Gomorrah, bad people. Bad people, but Jews, Israelites, we were above that. Nope. Here's a chapter of Genesis you probably don't read too carefully, chapter 47. So Joseph becomes vizier of all of Egypt. And what does he do? He enriches himself at the expense of everybody else. That his local clan, his tribe of Israelites, gets everything as a result of the Egyptian famine. First, Joseph collects payments. And then when the people are too impoverished to pay him for more grain, he collects their livestock. And then when they have no more livestock, Joseph puts in the royal treasury for himself and for the Egyptian elite and for his brethren, the Israelites, the sojourners, their land, and they become serfs and servants. And then when they have no land to speak of and no property rights left, he transfers them. He moves the Israelites and the favored few to the good lands and the resident Egyptians to other lands, to other difficult areas. And they are grateful. The Egyptians are grateful, even when he continues to tax them. The Egyptians become willing serfs. Arnold Cohen, I think this was Oliver Wendell Holmes, Arnold Cohen brought this to me, speaking that oppression creeps in like a thief in the night. I don't have the exact citation before me, but that's the nature of what happened under Joseph in Egypt. We think of him as one of our great heroes, but it'll be very hard to reread chapter 47 of Genesis again and think exactly that way. His record is not so clean. He too was corrupted by something like absolute power, and he too forgot that his family came down as sojourners, as victims, as weak players in the play, small parts. And when they got their big role, when the Jews got their big role in their society, they forgot that they used to have to play bit parts for decades. The last example I want to show you from Genesis is one you probably already know by now, slavery in Egypt. Now, just as Joseph and his cohort had impoverished the Egyptians, when a new pharaoh, a new king, comes to power, or so we're told it's a new king, more on that later, he decides to be wise, to be shrewd, to be cunning, says the dictionary with the term chacham, to judge, to make firm, to be crafty, and to treat the Israelites who had risen in social structure, beferach, with cruelty, with ruthlessness. What's really powerful and painful about that to our sages is the obvious question. Didn't this pharaoh, didn't this king know Joseph? Didn't the king know all the good that Joseph had done for prior kings? Was the king, was the pharaoh so immune and inured to history that he quickly and quietly forgot the necessities of other people? So Rashi and another sage, Chizkuni, two of our medieval rabbis, note this statement in Exodus 1:8 that a new king arose, a new ruler arose. And citing from Talmud and other places, they say there were a few ways to understand this. One, you could say that this really was a new king, that generations had passed and people had forgotten their history. The other said it was the same king, but he made new rules. He acted like he didn't know them. And says Chizkuni, he rose against Israel like an enemy. And as they say, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. And those who don't look very deeply into constitutional law or the varied racial histories of America or the oppressions we've perpetrated and endured at various times really are binding us to a future of oppression renewed. We live in a crazy time, a strange time, a new time. You know, people come up to me and ask me, what should I do? My child is marrying someone who's not Jewish. And my only response has been, we live in an era that our sages could never have predicted, an era of unprecedented integration of Jew and non-Jew, Jew and Gentile, Jews by choice and Jews by birth. And we live in the past decades in an era of unprecedented racial integration, multinational integration, global integration, integration of labor and immigration. And for most, at most times, in most ways, that's an amazing gift. Globalization is what brought millions out of poverty in the post-war era. But it's scary. It's scary not to think that our role is secure anymore, to know that we'll get to play Petruchio in Taming of the Shrew and not Hortensio, not some small bit part like the widow. It used to be that if you were tall and white and male, you were pretty well guaranteed your status in life. And our laws, our systems of justice, our systems of government throughout the ages perpetuated that setup. Now it's a lot harder to justify. I don't know if you've seen The Wire. I don't know if you've seen Atlanta. I don't know if you've listened to recent R&B and hip-hop. But the ascension of Latinos and blacks and women in music and art has been, I can speak from something I know well, exclusively a boon to art. And the ascension, for example, in another area that I know well, of women in the rabbinate has been a huge boon to Judaism in general and to religious life more globally. Don't be afraid. Sometimes the best parts to play in a play, I remember this, are the bit parts. They're fun. You get to make jokes. The lead always has to look good and be so serious. It's not so much fun. Better to play the villain or a minor character or the disgruntled uncle. Those are fun parts too. But how do we ensure equity of access to the play? How do we ensure that everyone will audition on a fair ground? What does it mean? Rule of law, something that Russia lacks, something that Zimbabwe lacks, something that Burma is only developing, Myanmar is only developing. A place where everyone adheres to the same law, where laws are just. You know, the Venn diagram of law and justice and morality often are like this, but at their ideal, they overlap quite a bit. In Pirkei Avot, in the wisdom of our sages, Rabbi Hanina, who was a high priest, said, "Pray for the well-being of government, because without the fear of authority, without rule of law, its very self, people would eat each other alive." Well, that's what's happening in Guinea. That's what's happening in Russia. That's what's happened in parts of West Africa and Colombia over the past decades. We are blessed, blessed to live in a country with a strong tradition of rule of law. The question is, can it be better? Can we make it better? Can we make it more universally applicable to all? Can we make our laws more fair and the execution of justice more equitable? Can we make the populations of prisons, if not necessarily lower, although that would be a good thing, but at least more representative of people who are doing the crimes? Life in a place where law is absurd is a mockery of God's justice. That's what the sages were saying when they talked about Sodom and Amorah. This is a place that looked like a fair place, that this was a place that looked like a just place, but it was not. I want to leave you with one more story. This comes from the Palestinian Talmud, the sections of the Talmud that we don't often read. So it tells the story of Alexander the great Jewish Greek ruler, visiting the king of Katsia. And he saw that the kingdom was wealthy and rich. He saw that it had silver and gold. And Alexander said, you know, I have a wealthy kingdom. I didn't come to see your silver and gold. I came to see your laws and your customs. How do you ordain justice? How do you ensure that law is fair? And as they were sitting, Alexander the Great and the local potentate, the local king, two people came for litigation before the king. Now, that's an incredibly inefficient way to do courts, but nonetheless. And one of them said to the king, my master, the king, I purchased a lot, one would say in modern English, from my friend. I demolished it, I tore it down, I was about to rebuild, and I found a treasure hidden inside. So I said to my friend, take your treasure. I purchased just the raised lot, not a treasure. And the friend who had sold him the lot said, just as you fear punishment for abusing the law, I do too. I sold you the ruin with the contingency that you got everything within it, from the depth of the earth to the heights of the heaven. Thereby, you have fair rights to that treasure. It's very sweet that they were fighting over who would get the treasure and not claiming it for each self. So the king of Katsia calls them together and he says to one, do you have a son? And the guy says, yes. He calls a second one and says, do you have a daughter? And the other guy says, yes. And he says, well, why don't they marry each other and then the treasure will stay in the family. I'm not saying that's great law. I'm just saying it's a cute story thus far. So here's the turn in the story. So Alexander the Great is amazed. Thought, well, that's very interesting how you do justice. And the king of Katsia says, yeah, don't I? I'm a good ruler, huh? You're pretty impressed with this. And Alexander says, I wasn't amazed because it was a good law. It's a terrible law. And the king of Katsia says, so what would you do in Macedonia or your lands if something like that would come to you? Now, there's no chance, the more I think about it, Sheldon could confirm this to me, that Alexander the Great was just sitting with some ruler he didn't rule, just visiting, you know, like an envoy. And Alexander the Great says, I'd cut off both their heads and send the treasure to the royal palace. That's how we do it in Greece. Everyone loses the treasure. And the king of Katsia says, at this awful registration of the law, at this awful prosecution of the law, he says to Alexander, he says, does the sun shine in your country? And Alexander says, yes. And he says, do you have rain there? And he says, yes, which are wonderful things that God provides. And then he thinks for himself, well, rain and sun can't be that bad a place to live. And he says, are there cattle and herds in your lands? And Alexander says, yeah, of course we have such things. And then the king of Katsia thinks for a second and he says, oh, the reason you have rain and sun is not because God loves you and respects you. It's just for your cattle and herds so they don't die. Meaning, I mean, I think it's a great joke if you live 1900 years ago. Joke being, God provides for all of us. And if you live in a cosmology where God provides for you and you do well because you are doing good things, then you should only get rain and sun if your law is just. And since it was clear to the king of Katsia that Alexander the Great's law was terribly, awfully unjust, the only reason, it couldn't be for the sake of the people who lived there that God protects the land with rain and sun, but just for the bugs and the dirt and the cattle and the cows and the chickens. That's how much our tradition draws it underline on justice. That's how much our tradition cares about justice. The assumption is that God will only be looking out for us if we're doing justice, if our laws are well legislated and well executed and well judged, and if our laws serve all equally and equitably and charitably, then God will be with us. So what do you do? There's a few hundred people in the room. What's your job now? You've heard the stories. Maybe you agree with me. Maybe you don't. I'm not forcing you to agree. I'm not taking a position that you have to affirm or deny. But let's say you want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. There's an understanding when people analyze the moral compass of people who rescued Jews during the Shoah, during the Holocaust, that their ultimate assumption was that they needed to report to a higher authority than the Nazis, than the Vichy government, than governments of Bulgaria. And they said in their own words, "I'd rather die with God and against men than with men and against God. I'd rather die with God and against men than with men and against God." I'm not asking you to be heroes. That sounds terrifying. I am asking you to try to, as John Locke and others of the Enlightenment would have said, try to find the natural law, God's moral law, that would undergird any meaningful assumption of democracy and rule of law. And now I'm going to guilt you just a little bit with a few quotes, and that's where I'll leave you. Just a little bit unsettled and maybe a little bit guilty. Me too. I certainly don't do enough. So in the Talmud, it says that the righteous are accountable if they could protest and did not. It's not enough not to be a bully. It's not enough not to be a racist. It's not enough to have a female boss. You also have to confront those who would do otherwise. And you have to stand up for legislation and legislators and executors of the law, judges, who would confront systemic problems in our society. Now, I honestly do believe, in one of the great countries in the world, and one of the greatest countries that's ever existed because of our Constitution, because of our aspirations to rule of law. And I could make some of the same cases for Israel as well. But it can always be better. You have to be part of that solution. And more recently, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said, "The prophets remind us, prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, Hosea, of the moral state of people. Few are guilty, but all are responsible." Most people in this room aren't part of the problem, but we're all responsible, all of us as Americans, all of us as Jews, all of us as lovers of freedom and seekers of justice. We're all responsible for making this world better. And I trust you to do it. Shana Tova.